Welcome to the Global Discussion, discussions with creatives, leaders, and thinkers. My name is Simon Hodgkin. It's a real pleasure to be joined by Mindy Gibbons-Klein. Mindy, you're very welcome to the show. Let's begin by asking you to introduce yourself and what you do for our worldwide audience.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show. I guess I'm best known as helping leaders become authors and speakers and thought leaders. Thought leadership is quite a new subject area. Well, it's not really, but most people have only started thinking about it maybe the past 10, 15 years. But that's what people really need to run their life and run their business is leadership and guidance, and especially thought leadership, you know, original, exciting, disruptive thinking, because, you know, it's such a mad world these days. And that's what I'm excited about, is people who are willing to step out and lead others in something important.
Well, you're in the right place, because here on the Global Discussion, we love talking to creatives and leaders and thinkers. And you're somebody that sort of steps across all of those sort of three areas. So let's talk a little bit about thought leadership. Let's talk a little bit about maybe the coaching of teams, the working with companies, the, you know, how do you actually go about being a successful thought leadership coach? How do you really work with people? What does that look like at a brass tacks level, like at a real operational level? What does it actually mean, Mindy?
Well, it's really very simple. There are already thought leaders, latent, dormant thought leaders in every organization. My particular fascination is with the small organization that finds themselves competing with a larger brand, because let's face it, the large brands have deep pockets. They can spend a lot on marketing and promotion, and the smaller company can't spend as much. That's a fact. But what they can do is they can tap into the thought leadership of key people in the business. And what we find is, well, first of all, in my discussions, very few organizations even know about this. They've never considered it. And when it comes time to find a face for the business or faces of the business, it's usually the founder, the CEO, maybe a few people in the C-suite. But it puts a lot of pressure on those people who are supposed to be running the company. And they are missing out on a more inclusive strategy that actually could empower and engage and inspire other people who, and you know, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do, to invest in people and show them that their ideas are worth sharing, not just the ideas of the C-suite. And there's a strategic way to do it. And it just tends to breed loyalty and appreciation. It's really fun and it's very valuable.
Now, that's really interesting what you said. And I want to ask you a follow-on question, if I may, because I know you've spent a lot of time in the publishing world. You know, you were 15, 16 years a managing director at a publishing company. But when it comes to engaging content, and we hear the word authenticity, don't we, a lot? And we hear, you know, getting to the facts of the matter. But what you're talking about there, it's sort of this new, in inverted commas, progressive leader, somebody that's willing to showcase others, to really share that, you know, real world expertise that maybe has been covered up or hasn't been explored yet. And do you find, this is my question really, do you find that because it's maybe a little bit more thoughtful, a little bit more worked through, a little bit more credible, that it engages better from a content perspective?
Well, it is ideally authentic, Simon, because it's individual people sharing their individual views, experience, expertise, opinions. You know, it can't be anything but. In fact, it's very hard to outsource that kind of authentic content. I'd almost go so far as to say it's impossible to outsource thought leadership, but that's another story. What you get is an individual who, through a very slick process, which I'm very proud of, gets to figure out what it is they add to the conversation, what specific ideas and expertise and opinions and you know, new concepts they will be able to write and speak about. And if they're given that opportunity, they tend to flourish. They can really shine. This is not for everyone, There are many individuals in every organization who would not want to do this. They don't want to be writing, speaking. They don't want to be seen or heard. And so it's not a question of forcing people. But when you get this variety of different voices, this diversity of thought out into the world, it reflects really well on the organizational brand. So it's just something very special that cannot be outsourced or delegated, in my opinion.
I really like what you're saying there. And I love the idea that you used the word dormant a little while ago, that these people are kind of in there. You just have to help them rise to the top to get that real genuine thought leadership out. And I do think it resonates well. So thank you for sharing that. Now, look, you're no stranger to thought leadership. You've actually wrote the book on thought leadership, okay?
A book, two books, four books now.
Yeah, and you've also won, I don't know, 18, 20-odd awards at this stage for all your work in lots of countries around the world. So when it comes to writing the books and also the work that you do there with the written word, could you maybe expand on that a little bit to our audience? Because I know you have the written word. We can maybe touch on, you're one of these people that, you know, you've done the 100 podcast episodes, you know, you're no stranger to the audio world either. And of course, the video and audio world that we find ourselves in today. Could you maybe unpack that a little bit and how that works into your world?
Yes, absolutely. So a thought leadership strategy is unique to each person. I'll say that. So even if there's a company program like the kind that I run, each individual has their own strategy and their own development plan. And, you know, some people do prefer writing. Some people prefer speaking. Some people have never done either and they can be developed. What I like about thought leadership, and you've touched on it, Simon, is there are so many different ways to get your ideas across. There are podcasts and videos and streaming. There's keynote speeches and training and other live events. Then there's articles, blogs. And when it comes to a book, I think, personally, a book is at the hub of a very powerful thought leadership strategy. Not everybody is going to write a book. Anybody can jump online and do a Facebook Live or LinkedIn Live. Anybody can write a short article. But I know what it takes to write books. I've been running The Book Midwife for 23 years now. And it is a major, major project. It's a very rewarding project, but it's a major undertaking and not everybody's going to do it. So I keep the brands separate because, you know, there's no way I want to force somebody to write a book. However, many people who would like to write a thought leading book really don't know where to start and they don't know what they have to say and they don't know how to package it, what format or style to use, what to put in, what to leave out. There's so many decisions. So that's my work with people who want to write a thought-leading book. But generally, in companies where they want to create this inclusive thought leadership strategy, it doesn't always involve a book. But I like having both businesses because that way we can cover lots of ways to get these ideas out there. And I love variety, and most other people do.
And any sort of quick tips for people, because obviously our audience is international, but they are made up of creatives and leaders and thinkers. And a lot of those people, some of them have written books, but a lot haven't for the very reasons that you've explained. Mm-hmm. So is there any sort of quick tips or, you know, for people that are maybe busy, bandwidth challenge, you know, they think they really want to write something, but they don't have the time. Where do they even start with that kind of challenge?
First of all, there are resources out there that can help shave the number of hours that it takes and the amount of time it takes to see that book done and in print. The Book Midwife programs being one option. The key, of course, is the level of motivation. So I don't like it when people say you've got to write a book. No, nobody's got to do anything. And somebody has to really, really want to put that time and effort in. It's not as much time and effort as they might think. I was just chatting with someone earlier and explained that our programs save people 100 hours of their time compared to what they'd spend if they tried to have a go on their own, what we call the DIY book. Not a book about DIY, but doing it yourself without any help or guidance. The exciting thing is you end up with something tangible at the end of it. So it is worth doing it, but I believe it's worth doing well. And if your name's going to be on it, putting your best efforts into it, getting help, advice, and guidance, getting input from a coach and being on some kind of program, because these programs exist to make things faster, more efficient, better. I think that was your question. I think the first tip is decide how important it really is. Put a number on it, prioritize it. Our programs are all 90 days in length. So I think somebody could prioritize the book for 3 months and get on with their life after that. And people don't always do that. If they do the DIY, it takes on average 2.5 years. And that's daunting. That's something that nobody really wants to think about. But if you could get something done, you know, be it a book or, you know, a good video series, or you can do it in chunks of time, like 3 months. That's what I would suggest, is to, you know, be honest about the level of motivation and carve out a specific period of time to get something done so it doesn't take over your life and drag on and on.
Well, thank you. That's great advice. And thank you for sharing that with our audience, Mindy. I do appreciate it. And it brings me nicely onto something else I wanted to ask you about, because as well as, you know, whether it's podcasts or the books or the coaching with the teams and the corporate clients and the small businesses, but you're no stranger to talking, whether that's TED, TEDx, or whether it's public speaking in general. And you do an awful lot of that too. And we do find that a lot of thought leaders or a lot of people that want to share a message, they want to get into that public speaking. When we talk about that sort of public speaking from a business perspective, how does that work for you? Is that something that you just love doing, or is it part and parcel of the wider thought leadership sort of wrapper?
It's both. Ever since I was a young lass, I wanted to be on a stage. I thought it was going to be doing plays and things like that. Turns out, you know, I'm a speaker and trainer. Yay. It's fun for me. And I also think it's very efficient. When you have a one-to-one conversation, it's very intimate, small group. When you can speak to a big audience and you can actually get that message across to hundreds of people at the same time, I love efficiency. And so I think that is one aspect of it that I respect and why I continue to do it. It's also, I like having a bit of fun and, you know, being a creative. I'm always doing something unexpected when I'm having a chance to speak to an audience. And I like that. It's fun for me and hopefully fun for them. So I would encourage, again, the same kind of advice. I'd encourage people to think about why they would want to do it, not just because it's a trendy thing to do, and to really make it to the top of the professional speaking industry. You do need to be good. You need to have very substantive content. You need to practice a lot in terms of getting a lot of gigs and just doing it. And some people don't like the idea of being on the road, or, you know, less now because there's a lot of virtual. But just consider all of that before saying, I want to be a speaker, because it sounds glamorous. And much of the time it's not. And it's just, you know, putting your hours in, I can't tell you how many how many hours of slog I've put in over 30 plus years. But I'm willing because, you know, I love it and I get better with every speech, I feel. So, yeah, if that inspires somebody, then go for it. Get some help, get some coaching, and be willing to put in the hours.
Yeah, I really like that. And a theme that sort of seems to come in is the coaching, is the help, is the resources that are out there. And, you know, to anybody watching or listening to our conversation today, you, on one hand, you're doing an awful lot, but on the other hand, you do point out that, look, over the last 10, 20, 30 years, I've worked this out. I've got the processes in place. I've got the way this works. And I'm sure there's lots of hard work and hard slog still that takes place. But it brings me on to something else, which I know is very dear to you and something that you're really passionate about now. And also something that I think for thought leaders and for people that want to share a message, it's really risen to the top of the boardroom agenda, and that's social impact. Could you tell me, well, first of all, share with our audience some of the work that you're doing around the social impact space and how that fits into the wider world that you're involved in, because I think what you're doing there is really interesting.
Oh, thank you. Well, what happened, Simon, is during the pandemic, our businesses, it did very well. There's no other way to put it. A lot of people had time, decided to write books, and we were there for them. And so it was very rewarding for all. And we had a very, very good year or two. It was during that time when I was reflecting on the business and life, as we all did during the pandemic. And I just had this thought that my income had gone up, but I didn't think my giving had kept up. And that was the trigger for me to do a calculation and look at my charitable giving, my regular giving. And I just did a calculation to figure out what percentage of my income I was giving to charity. And I was absolutely shocked and distressed and very upset, actually. I was in tears thinking, I thought I was a caring, thoughtful person. And, we've heard of tithing and zakat and things like that, but we don't always give 10% or know what we're giving. And I knew my number wasn't 10%, and I thought it might be 4 or 5%. Turns out it was 0.5%. And that was not good enough for me individually. And so I did a few things. I raised my regular donations to the charities that I'd chosen, and I felt a bit better. But then I started having that conversation with people. Everywhere I went, people said, "Oh, I never really thought about it." And I realized that's the problem. They're not thinking about it. Charitable giving is an afterthought or a spiky thing that we think of when a friend of ours is running a marathon or when it's Comic Relief, Red Nose Day, or, but then we forget about it again. And I started talking to charities, and it turns out that they really need regular giving. They need monthly donations rather than these spiky things because they can't forecast and budget with those. And individuals might like to know that X percent of their monthly budget, if you want to call it that, is charitable donations. And to set those up, and I'm not going to say set and forget because that's what I did, but set and maybe look at once a year. So where does that lead us? I worked with a small, very, very thoughtful, wonderful team of people to create a brand called Giving 1%. And we've created giving1%.com, which is simply a place where people can think about their charitable giving, do a calculation, figure out what percentage of their income they're already giving, and then decide what to do with that. So we don't take donations on the site. We don't even point people to specific charities, which, everybody thinks that we're going to advise them where they should donate their money. No, it's just a place to stop and think, but we do have a big, ambitious goal. And thank you for asking. The charity industry, if you want to call it that, charities generally and causes, lost over $450 billion during the pandemic. Why? Because people panicked, people were fearful, all the uncertainty, the doubt. Many, many, many people and organizations canceled their regular donations. So charities need real money to do their work. And I'm determined to find 10 million people who would donate on average about £35 a month each, and that will recoup the global shortfall. I want us to do this in the UK, but it's a global initiative. I could talk for hours, but if people would just go to giving1%.com, I'm sure you'll share the link in the show notes. It's just something that I think people will be grateful to know about. So thank you for asking.
No, and thank you. I think it's a wonderful initiative, and I know there's a calculator on there. People can work out, whether it's in US dollars or whatever, they can work out what percentage they're actually giving and their income versus their giving. But the thing that I really like about it is having a social impact. Of course, being related to you, Mindy, it has a huge, global, audacious goal attached to it. Of course, it does. But also the fact that it makes you think. It makes you stop and think. And as you were saying, when you take an evaluation of that, when you think, well, do you know what? Some businesses and businesses I'm involved in really did really well during the pandemic. And it does that little pause, that little space to think and reflect and think about that. I think it's such an important endeavor. So thank you for doing it. And I do encourage people to go to giving1%.com, the number one, giving1%.com, and check out all the wonderful things that are happening there. And look, let's move it on. Let's talk about the roadmap then, because people plan in different ways. Some people take each day as it comes. Other people are meticulously working through Excel spreadsheets. But how do you plan? What's the next 6 to 12 months look like for you, Mindy? What's on your horizon? What's on your roadmap? And what are you hoping to achieve in the future?
Well, the next 6 to 12 months are planned out because I always do goal setting. When I say planned out, it may not result exactly as the plan states. And this is the funny thing. I used to teach goal setting and things have changed. Our world has changed. You cannot predict exactly where you're going to be in 6 months, much less 12, 18, 24 months. So having the goal is great, but leaving it porous around the outside, that's the way I describe it. It's not a fixed container in a box. It's allowing things to come in and go out and morph and shift, and allowing the magic that is, our everyday world and the universe, whatever you want to call it, the random connection that you might make next week, to impact that and allowing some changes. So I do have some creative goals, as you noted. I have this social impact project. I have the existing business, so both businesses helping people write books and helping them become thought leaders and speakers. And I also have some creative projects that have been on the back burner for a long time. And it wasn't until I slowed down and sold the publishing company that I had the time and space to consider them. So I'll just say some writing and musical projects without getting into too much detail. But I'm also open to these random opportunities and what comes up. It's a balance, I think.
Yeah, I like that word that you use, that sort of porous outer shell to the plan, and the fact that, things change, whether it's 6 days or 6 months or 6 years down the road, it is getting harder to predict. And so many things are happening that maybe at a much faster pace now. And I also love, after selling the publishing business, which was a hugely successful, you did that for many, many years, and also freeing up space to be able to focus on other endeavors and other entities. Because you're still pretty busy, Mindy, with everything that you've got going on for sure. And look, I've got another question I want to ask you, and I don't want to run out of time because I do like to ask guests if there's anything else that you'd like to share with our worldwide audience while we have them with us today on this episode. That may be something we've touched on already that you want to maybe expand on, or it might be something completely new, totally up to you. And secondly, and importantly, if people want to reach out and connect with you, whether it's about giving1%.com or whether it's about your public speaking, whether it's about the coaching that you do with the teams, or whether it's about writing a book, where is the best place to point people to reach out and connect these days, Mindy?
Okay, so if there's just one thing that I would leave people with, is we have so many choices, but we often don't realize that we have a choice to become thoughtful, caring leaders. It's something that I guess many people think you're either thoughtful or you're not. You're right. But thoughtfulness is there for everybody, and I believe we are, in our nature, thoughtful human beings. So it's a question of spending time on it, taking time to reflect. It's why my current brand is the thoughtful leader. So it's not thought leadership. It's not how much content can I churn out. It's about being thoughtful in both senses of the word. So putting more thought into our conversations, what we produce, our interactions, and being thoughtful, as in considerate of others, and that includes ourselves. You know, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives? What can we do? What could we do more? You know, that's what drives me. Could we be better? And could we be more thoughtful? So I would urge people to spend a bit of time reflecting on that. And there are ways to cultivate thoughtful leadership. The Thoughtful Leader book and podcast, that's obviously the first place that I would recommend. But if people want to reach out to me personally, mindygk.com. So I do have a very long surname and many people spell it wrong. So I just created Mindy GK. So it's like one name, like Madonna or Beyonce, you know, Mindy GK. And that's the obvious place where people can connect with me, find out about my work. I'm always happy to connect if I can on LinkedIn. I'm running out of connections now, but people can follow my work there. And you know, don't be shy to connect. I hope I'm as approachable as I think I am. And I always want to hear from positive, forward-thinking people and thoughtful people.
I really like that. Fantastic. And thanks so much for sharing those sort of final thoughts and also where people can connect with you. That's very, very helpful. And look, that brings us nicely to the end of this episode today on the Global Discussion. I want to take a moment just to thank everybody who's been watching or listening to our discussion today. Make sure that you follow, subscribe, do everything I need you to do to help support the show. And of course, go and check out all the wonderful things that Mindy is involved in. And make sure that you join me back here for some more discussions with creatives and leaders and thinkers just like Mindy. Thank you, Mindy. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you again today.
Thank you, Simon.